And I might, because I've got an appointment tomorrow morning, I might be leaving you before you finish your section, Roy, in which case you just simply pass it over to Paul. AC2GS, K2RIW. Go ahead, Roy.
Okay, very good, Dick. I do have a little topic at the early portion of my my segment that I'd like to have your input for, but it should be very early on. As always, I want to remind people that if you have any mailbag questions for Dick, if you have any subjects or websites you'd like Paul to look at and comment about, if you have any topics, comments, suggestions, puzzlers for me, the mailbag address, email address is mailbag@ac2gs.com. Again, mailbag@ac2gs.com. And anything I talk about, for the most part, will be available on my link page. It will give you links that you can click to the articles that talk about the subjects that I've spoken about. And that is roy.ac2gs.com. Again, the link page is roy.ac2gs.com. Also, let me just mention, going back a second, to Rich, WB2GXM's question and the comments. I think what everyone was sort of talking about were solder masks. They're not quite the same as photoresist, but they're put down. They're made of different materials. The cheapest is epoxies. They're very tough. They're very durable. There probably are industrial solvents that can remove them, but it's expensive and dangerous and difficult to find. So as everyone was suggesting to Rich, the answer is just abrasion. Anyway, let me drop for a second, and I will go to a mailbag question this week. Okay, tonight we have a mailbag question from Brandon. That's KB1THM. He asked the question last week via Echolink, and his question is the following, Dick. He says, will common mode currents on a coaxial feed line cause interference to other radios in a multi-transmitter environment, such as during field day? Or is it the close proximity of the radios in the same room and maybe the case of transceivers that aren't shielded well enough? He goes on, I am in Connecticut, right across Long Island Sound, and at our club we have been having interference during field day and other special events we run. We have multiple transmitters running at once. For our last event, Winter Field Day, January 25th, 26th, we experimented with a bandpass filter. From low band systems, a member had brought them for us to try. Supposedly, they provided 65 to 90 decibels of rejection in the adjacent bands. He had three of them, one for 80 meters, one for 40, and one for 20. All three radios seemed to have interference between whenever someone would transmit, even with these filters installed. The three antennas were well spaced, but still set up on the same property to within 1,500 feet. We had a G5RV for 20 meters, another one for 40 meters, and a vertical for 80 meters. The G5RV had a couple turns of coax zip-tied in a loop at its feed point, and the vertical the same thing. Nothing special. Someone had suggested that we try this, he said. The other wire antenna had no choke. All three coaxial feed lines came into the same hole to enter our building. They were RG8X. And all three were touching each other. After adding these chokes, the issues seemed to get a little bit better, but most of the radios were experiencing receiver overload. Not as bad as before, but with no wraps of coax. Do you think these air-wound coax chokes we tried were effective? Or is this not an optimal way to prevent current flow on the shield of a coax? I've seen people take coax and wind it into a PVC form and say that's effective. Would there be a certain length that would only work at a certain frequency? I've also seen an article where people wind coax around a toroid to make a choke. Is this effective? Would these be monoband chokes, meaning we would need to wind different ones for different bands? And his last question is, say the chokes solve the interference issue. I know I'm getting ahead of myself. Would it now be okay to run all coaxial cables into the same hole in the wall, or should we never have them in contact with each other? So that's Brandon's bunch of questions for tonight.
Well, I'm not going to have great answers for all of those. In the case of interference, the chain is no stronger than the weakest link. Got a whole lot of mechanisms of coupling through the air coupling of the antennas themselves, through the coaxial cable common mode currents, and there's various ways that common mode currents can be launched onto the cable, and sometimes you can lower that. The coils of wire, the coils of the coax, the right number of turns of the coils, you get enough inductive reactance. I mean, there's a formula you've got in the early chapter of the Radio Amateur's Handbook, where if you know the diameter of the coil, the number of turns, and the spacing of the turns, if there is any spacing, you plug in those numbers and it'll tell you how many microhenries you've got. Once you know the microhenries, you use the formula of 2 pi FL. And so you take the microhenries, that's the L, multiplied by 2 pi, multiplied by the frequency, I think it's in hertz, and that tells you how many ohms of inductive reactance your coil is going to give you. And if you can make that inductive reactance, let me pick a number, 1,000 ohms, you're going to be getting a whole lot of isolation. But let me drop. Your inline filter having 40, 50, 60 dB of isolation sounds good. But if the second harmonic coming out of the transmitter is 20 decibels down, in some cases they are, and if it's a kilowatt transmitter, which means it's running plus 60 dBm, that's what a kilowatt is, 20 dB down from 60 is plus 40 dBm. 40 or 50 or 60 dB of shielding of a filter brings you down to 0 minus 10 dBm. The receiver in question might have a sensitivity of minus 100 dBm, and so you can see there's a lot of missing decibels there. Even though the frequency is wrong, the actual rig itself has a certain amount of out-of-band dynamic range or rejection capability. Your 40-meter receiver maybe can only tolerate a 20-meter signal that's 40 dB down before its front end starts becoming overloaded, particularly if there's a preamp involved that can be turned on or turned off. So, and running the coax cables all together through the same hole to bring them into the shack, that is another aggravating factor. You're going to get some tight coupling there between the coaxes if there's any signals riding on them. It's going to take a lot of experiment, and there's no simple solution to this. The guys of the expedition group at W1, I can't think of the call letters right now, at Mount Greylock, they've had to do a lot of experimenting to make all of their VHF rigs runnable simultaneously without interfering with each other. That's some of the answers. I know that's not a great answer, but at least it gives you a little bit of information about how you can do some calculating as to whether or not your coil is adequate. Is it giving you enough isolation? Does it have enough turns, enough diameter, enough coax cable devoted to it? And as I said, it's going to take experimentation. AC2GS, K2RIW.
Thank you, Dick. I thought you might want to just make a few statements about the shielding ability of coaxial cables, that you can relatively put them close together if they're of good quality without worrying about too much of the coupling of the transmission signals.
There's rough numbers on this. In the case of single shield type coax cables, RG8, RG8X, and so on, two cables in close proximity to each other, I don't think each one is shielded by more than about 60 dB. Does that mean you're going to get 120 dB shielding of the two of them together? Not necessarily. Double shielded cable like RG9, RG214, they can give you 90 decibels of shielding if the connector on the end is well installed. So where you want a lot of shielding between the cables themselves, there's a lot to be said by choosing a brand of cable that has a double shield to it as opposed to a single shield. And the tightness of the braid, how much you spend on the coax cable, does it have a tight braid or a loose braid? That makes a huge difference, particularly the guys in foreign countries that have to order coax cable to be imported to their country. Sometimes what's available to them is rather sparsely shielded, if you know what I mean. They skimp on the number of wires in the shielding structure. So RG214, RG9 are yes, they're the larger diameter, but they're double shielded. And there's probably, I think there's an RG214, no, RG256. There is a RG58 diameter cable, which is double shielded. It might be RG256. Here, I'm not sure. But you're using a RG8X. I think that's only single shielded. So the leak is between the shields, and how close they're in contact, for what length, how many feet in length are they in contact with each other, that's another factor. All of it requires experimentation. Whichever one of those signals, by the jumping between cables, jumping around the shielding of the filter, jumping from antenna to antenna in free space, all of these signals are competing, and the strongest one getting through is the one you attack first. And it takes some pretty fancy experimentation to find out which is the strongest one right now. And that's the one that should be worked on. AC2GS, K2RIW.
Okay, very good. Thank you, Dick. I think Brandon got a lot out of this, and he's listening on Echolink. He's not able to transmit through Echolink tonight, but I'm sure if he has any other questions, he'll email me or he'll text them down on Echolink, and I'm sure he's happy with your answers. Let me drop for a second, and I'll give you another sort of mailbag question. It was mentioned in the chat room last Sunday, and it kind of interestingly bridges between both the first hour TechNet and the Science Talk TechNet. So let me drop for a second, and we'll get on to the second one. Okay, the gentleman in the chat room, Mark, he posed an interesting question. He asked, with regard to Dick's discussion of noted physicist John Krauss's explanation of the infinitesimal dipole, he wondered if there was an analogy for the world of acoustic waves. He asked, is there an infinitesimal efficient loudspeaker practically or even theoretically possible? And if not, why are acoustic waves that different from electromagnetic waves?
Yeah, pretty good question, and there is an answer to it. The infinitesimal dipole has a whole lot of effective capture area because of a peculiar resonance effect. You resonate first, then you can radiate. I'll go into that in a few minutes. In the case of a loudspeaker, you do the extreme opposite of resonating. If your loudspeaker had a resonance to it, it'll sound tubby, and it'll be emphasizing that particular frequency or wrong. You'd like an ideal loudspeaker to go from 20 hertz to 20 kilohertz and be completely flat, or at least a very straight line in its performance of voltage in versus the amount of sound coming out. So your loudspeaker is a very, if it's properly damped and properly mounted and properly being used, and properly loading resistor, your audio amplifier, an ideal world, acts like a 50 ohm resistor, so to speak, and it loads the loudspeaker at all frequencies so that there is the extreme opposite of resonance. In the case of an antenna, almost all of the antennas we use are so-called standing wave antennas. They resonate. I'll give you a simple analogy which will help understand where all this effective capture area is coming from. Let me drop. The sample I use so often is that a 80-meter dipole, full size, made out of 14-gauge wire, is 132 feet long, tip to tip. The wire itself casts a shadow on the ground of approximately 1 square foot. Common sense would lead you to believe that that wire picking up a radio signal is going to have a capture area of 1 square foot. We go through the maximatics. Gain equals 4 pi a over lambda squared. That's the main base equation for an antenna. Rearrange the letters. Area is gain lambda squared over 4 pi. So you plug in the numbers, gain lambda squared over 4 pi, you'll find out that 80-meter dipole has an effective capture area of 8,500 square feet. In other words, you set up the dipole at a reasonable altitude. You know how strong the signal is coming in from a mile away, we'll say, and you measure how much signal comes out of that dipole into your power measuring device in the shack. And you do the mathematics of that, and you'll find out it's got 8,500 square feet. In other words, if you set up absorbing material, anechoic material, 8,500 square feet of it, a great big oval in space that's a around 150 feet wide, right where the dipole is going to be. If your eyes operated at 80 meters and you looked into the dipole broadside, you'd see this great big black oval around the dipole. And where is that oval coming from? It's coming from resonance. Let me drop. And I'll give you an example of resonance. Your child is on a swing. And because the child is a certain weight and the length of the chain on the swing going up to the pivot has a certain length to it, there is a definite resonant frequency. The child swings back and forth maybe once per 2 seconds. There's a definite favored frequency at which the child swings at, and probably no other frequency. Now you're pushing the child with your finger. You're pressing your finger on the back of the child, and you're doing that in resonance. Each time the child is moving forward, you're pressing your finger on the back of the child. And after the child swings 10 or 20 times, you build up a nice, strong amplitude of swing because it's a resonant system being pushed at the resonant frequency. You're automatically doing that. Well, the dipole has a very favored resonant frequency. If you set it up at a particular length, maybe it resonates at 3.5 megahertz. The signal coming in is at 3.5 megahertz. When you're pushing the child does not build up to full amplitude instantaneously. It takes 10 or 20 swings of you pushing on each swing before the child builds up a good-sized amplitude on how far the child is swinging. The same thing happens with the signal coming into the dipole. It takes some number of cycles of that 80-meter signal coming into the dipole before the dipole comes up to full amplitude of signal on its resonant wire. And when the wire does resonate, there's a fair amount of resonant energy bouncing back and forth within the dipole itself. Very similar to what's happening with the child. Resonant energy of the child swinging back and forth on that swing. It's got a rise time. The child has a rise time. The dipole has a rise time. It's some number of microseconds before the signal comes up to full amplitude on that dipole. That's the magic of resonance. That's where the effective capture area is coming from. Let me drop. If the dipole is very short, it's not 132 feet long, it's only 30 feet long, but you've added loading coils and top hat capacitors and zigzag wiring and helical winding and so on. You've done various things to take the very small physical dipole and bring it up to electronic resonance with a low loss at 3.7 megacycles in my example. Once you bring it up to resonance, it'll have the exact same rise time phenomenon. So the circulating energy, the Q of the circuit, Q has got about five different definitions. Center frequency divided by bandwidth, a function of rise time and fall time, energy circulating versus energy being dissipated. I can't think of all of them right now, but the infinitesimal dipole, the magic of all of its capture area, where it picks up the big signal, even though it's physically small. You make the dipole one quarter of the length, you would assume that the length is one quarter, the height is one quarter, you assume you're going to get 1/16 of the signal. You'll get full amplitude of signal per se. As you shrink down a dipole and keep it resonant with high efficiency materials, you never lose more than half a dB from the full-size dipole. The infinitesimal dipole is never half a dB down. And the half a dB down in response is not loss. It's because the antenna pattern became a little bit broader because the dipole doesn't have as much length. The radiating surface is a little bit different, and you get a slightly different pattern. Half a dB. You don't only lose half a dB in the ideal world when you're using the right materials. So your loudspeaker being thoroughly broadband, non-resonant, doesn't have any cue to it, doesn't have a chance of building up that amplitude. It's the equivalent of a child on a swing where the child is dragging its feet on the ground so there is no resonance. And now you push the child on each swing, and you're not going to build up a large amplitude because of the DQing function of the child dragging his feet on the ground. Not a great example, but maybe it gets some of the principle across. So resonate first, then it will radiate. Almost, and the signal bouncing back and forth that sustains the resonance, that's what forces us to call it a standing wave structure. There's a real standing wave on that dipole, and a non-resonant antenna, a beverage or a rhombic antenna with a loading resistor at They have a very different phenomenon. They require many wavelengths of length in order to build up full performance. You can't build an infinitesimal beverage or an infinitesimal rhombic and get full performance. But on a standing wave structure of a dipole, you can.
Repeater. Timeout.
Nothing heard on the Eastern repeater.
Repeater. Timeout. Cancel.
Yeah, what I've just learned is you don't want to time out this repeater. It takes a long time for it to come back. So the loudspeaker, being non-resonant, doesn't have this phenomenon. From the shaky explanation I gave, does that make some sense, Roy? AC2GS, K2RIW?
It makes excellent sense to me, Dick. I just thought I would kind of introduce some other little thing that I was reading on the subject, and that's the interesting subject of acoustic impedance. There seems to be a acoustic version of impedance the same way of an electrical impedance. And in some ways, I think you can imagine the question as being related to impedance transformation of the acoustic wave. If you introduce a device that effectively transforms a very high impedance of a very small speaker system into a low impedance that interacts with air more efficiently, you end up making a more resonant sound device. At least from what I've been reading.
But in my understanding of a sound device, you do not want resonance. You want to avoid it. It's going to give you a tubby sound at some particular portion of the spectrum. Yes, there is an acoustic impedance. Your audio signal coming down the wires going into your loudspeaker is driving the coil. The coil, in turn, is driving air, and that's got an impedance. But the loudspeaker acts more like a dummy load. A dummy load for your transmitter is a 50-ohm resistor across all frequency regions if it's an ideal one. So it's a very broad-band 50-ohm resistor. And the acoustic impedance has a similar phenomenon, non-resonant, if the loudspeaker is properly designed and properly being used. So the infinite dipole and infinitely small loudspeaker is not going to give you the same amount of sound coming out or the same amount of signal being coupled in or going out, whether it be a microphone or a loudspeaker. So that analogy between the two, I think, does not work. That's my impression on this one, Paul. Roy, AC2GS, K2RIW.
D2IS comment.
Spell. AC2IS, K2RIW. Go ahead, Bill.
Yeah, I'm assuming that I heard it on these airwaves, the idea that in the old school Victrola horn was basically an impedance matching device, you know, because the horn, you know, would slowly be the natural impedance of open air, whatever that is. But what I was going to attempt to summarize what you said earlier. It sounds like you're saying that an electrical antenna is a high-Q device, and a audio speaker is a low-Q device. So the high-Q device is very resonant at a specific frequency, and like you said, the audio speaker is not, the idea is to not be resonant at a specific frequency to if anything, have thin resonance, probably low resonance across a wide range of frequencies. So that's what's different, right? The antenna is made to work for a specific frequency. Or is made to work for a wide range of frequencies and therefore does not resonate. But then that introduces another question in my mind. Okay, if you made a speaker that was resonant at a particular frequency, only made to produce that one frequency, would it then have a quote-unquote large capture area, AC2IS?
I'm holding on to a X-band horn, a standard gain horn, and I think it's got about 2.5 inches of width and about 2 inches of height of the open end horn itself, the so-called standard gain horn for the X-band frequency region, the horn is usable from, I think it's 4.8 to 10.4 or something like that frequency. It's a couple of gigahertz of frequency. It has no resonance to it. It's a broadband impedance matching device without resonance. As such, the effective capture area is what you see. When you look into the mouth of the horn, you'll see a certain number of square inches. And despite a slight efficiency factor of coupling, that's the number of square inches of effective capture area you get across the whole frequency region, 8 to 12 gigahertz, if that's where it operates. So a horn-like antenna, an area antenna, and a parabolic dish antenna, the area that you see is the area that you get. In the case of a dipole, a highly resonant structure, the area that you see could be 8,000 to 1 different than the real effective radio area. Let me drop this. So if I relate that horn antenna to the horn of a loudspeaker-like device, it too can be broadband, non-resonant. It's got some kind of a diaphragm-like device at the small end, and the signal slowly branches out through that horn, comes out of the large end, and the effective capture area of that structure is going to be similar to the area that you see when you look into that open end. So horn-like structures, you might be led to believe it's resonant. Properly designed, they're very non-resonant, extremely broadband. So does that make a little bit of sense, Bill? AC2IS, K2IW?
Sure. I mean, the horn that I was describing, I was just describing as an impedance matching device. I was not making any comments about that horn having any particular resonant frequency, but if there's any question I had, it was, hey, can we make an example of a infinitesimal dipole in an analog in the audio world by making it a single frequency device that was, say, much, much smaller than a wavelength and yet still had the quote-unquote capture area of at least a wavelength, AC2IS.
VDH with a comment.
VDH recognized. The I should have mentioned that standard gain horn at X-band, made by a number of good companies, when you plot its gain versus frequency from 8.4 to 12.4 gigs, it's a very straight line curve. It's got a slight slant to it, higher gain at the higher frequency because there's more wavelengths involved in that fixed number of square inches of horn. But it's a very non-resonant structure. And can you take an infinitesimal acoustic device and make it resonant when it's sub-wavelength in length? That's not impossible, but difficult. If you did resonate it, would you then get this increase of capture area with a certain amount of rise time to it and fall time? Yes, I think the answer is yes. The person who just joined us, please give your call letters and name once more, K2RIW.
Yeah, fine business. This is WA2VDH. Name is John. I was just thinking a case where you have a resonant acoustical system might be those pipes that you see underneath a xylophone. Each one of those pipes is tuned to the particular note, and it does increase the acoustic radiation from each of the notes since it's resonant to that particular note. So that would be, I guess, an acoustically resonant speaker. Go ahead.
Yeah, I think I agree, John, except that now that rod is a quarter wave or half wave long. I don't think you can make that rod an infinitesimal fraction of a wavelength and still get that acoustic resonance and that sound reproduction amplitude. So with acoustics, it's more difficult to get this infinitesimal dipole function out of it. I think each of your acoustic resonance devices are physically a good fraction of a wavelength long. Does that sound reasonable, John? Go ahead.
Yeah, well, I think those pipes underneath the xylophone, I think they're essentially like contain an acoustic standing wave. Yeah, they probably are like a quarter wave long or something. I think they're open ended. But they do reinforce the acoustic radiation. from each particular xylophone note. I think without those pipes, the sound from the xylophone note would be a lot weaker.
In the case of a non-resonant loudspeaker or non-resonant microphone, if you instantaneously turn on a acoustic sound, a tone generator, the microphone, as soon as that sound hits the microphone, it gives you full amplitude. It's got a rise time that's essentially zero, or a fraction of a cycle. Non-resonant behaves that way. A high Q structure, a resonant dipole, or this resonant rod that you're describing, the acoustic rod, if you now turned on a local sound source, and you're measuring the amplitude of the sound inside of that rod, find out because it's got Q to it, it's got a certain amount of rise time. The rise time is a function of its bandwidth. Q is a set of frequency divided by bandwidth. So it takes maybe 10 or 100 cycles of the sound coming in before the sound in the rod comes up to full amplitude. So that's the difference in criteria between resonant and non-resonant. So in resonance, you can get the infinite dipole phenomena. With non-resonance, I think you cannot. You have to devote a real number of dipoles, a real number of lengths to the circuit in order to get full performance. Infinitesimal is not going to give you that full performance. You cut that rod down to a small fraction where it doesn't resonate. You're not going to build up any real signal on it at all, is my understanding. I don't know who should get it. K2RIW listening. You've got it, Roy.
Okay, very good, Dick. Thank you, Dick. Thanks, John and Bill, for participating. I thought it would be an interesting little diversion from, like I said, it doesn't strike me as completely purely TechNet. It's kind of a nice mix between TechNet and Science Talk. So I appreciate the explanation, Dick.
There's a whole lot of people who don't know where the effective capture area is coming from on a very small antenna structure. Small antennas are a real science in themselves, and a number of very smart guys have devoted various methods of deriving the mathematics of what's happening. As you can tell, I've got a sort of a physical definition of where it's coming from, which depends on the standing wave resonance structure slowly building up an amplitude as the signal is applied to it. And so you have to wait some number of cycles. Every structure that resonates has a measurable, calculatable rise time. X number of cycles are required before it comes up to full amplitude, or X number of cycles are required before it damps down. When the signal is turned off, the signal doesn't instantaneously die on that antenna. It slowly decays in an exponential manner. So resonance is the magic. A hell of a lot of things work a lot better with resonance. But when it comes to antennas, the most important seven words of the English language to me, if you're an antenna designer, is you resonate first and then it will radiate. With that philosophy in mind, you can build tiny antennas inside of your cell phone, as long as you've got a tuning structure nearby that'll tune it to the frequency you desire at this instant. Those tiny antennas inside of your cell phone give you full performance of the whip antenna that used to come out of the cell phone in the old days. AC2GS, K2RIW.
Well, the way I see it, resonance kind of improves the ability, maximizes the ability to store energy and then transfer energy. And thankfully, electronics allows you to electronically modify the resonant frequency of a given antenna without necessarily mechanically changing it. So that I think is the beauty point when it comes to electromagnetism, that you can put in a couple of capacitors, inductors, and kind of shift the resonant frequency electronically, whereas acoustically you're sort of stuck with mechanical objects that take up a lot of space in the first place. So that's at least the way I see resonance.
Yeah, you're right, Roy. That antenna tuner can really do magic. As long as you've got a low-loss feed line between you and almost any kind of an antenna, and if you've got a broad enough tuning range of your antenna tuner, You can force your antenna to work on almost any frequency you desire. In fact, one of the questions here in the puzzle that was given to me is, I can't find the particular chapter. I should find. Back to you, Roy. KGRIW.
Okay, very good. Like I said, I found this a very interesting question. I mean, that's why I like people to participate either through EchoLink text or EchoLink audio or chat room. This particular question came to me from the chat room or from the email because, you know, I wasn't really thinking in terms of acoustic impedance before this. So I thank Mark for pointing me in this direction, and I thank you, Dick, for exploring it with me.
Yeah, this particular puzzle was a true-false. The antenna must be a resonant length for maximum current to flow in it. Not true. As long as you're willing to put the right kind of an antenna tuner on that antenna, you can force it to resonate on essentially any frequency. The antenna tuner, if it's made correctly, has no insertion loss. Another thing hard to believe. All that signal reflected from your antenna because of its standing wave ratio comes back to the antenna tuner, gets re-reflected forward in phase with the signal coming out of the transmitter right now and eventually radiated if the feed line is low enough in loss. There's a hell of a lot of people who believe all the reflected energy from an antenna gets into the antenna tuner and gets wasted, gets thrown away as heat. Absolutely not true. Well-designed antenna tuner runs ice cold. The transmitter sees a perfect 50-ohm load. The antenna sees whatever impedance is required to force it into resonance with good impedance match at the frequency you desire when the antenna tuner is properly tuned. Back to you, Roy. I'm going to be going away. Bye-bye for now. AC2GS, K2RIW.
Do I ask comment?
Yes, Bill, please, comment.
I'm just thinking of this speaker still. I'm trying to, I think I have an example of, say, a very low frequency sound. 20 hertz is audible by humans, right? So supposing you just had a spring that would naturally oscillate at 20 hertz when you tapped it. And, you know, let's say you put a little metal plate on the end of that spring that, you know, that metal plate, a lightweight metal plate, say, moving back and forth would be rigid. It would interact with the air. That would be, you tune that so that it still oscillates in air at 20 hertz, and then you connect a little piezoelectric speaker to it, and you pump 20 hertz into that. Now, do you not have your 20 hertz specific, single frequency specific speaker? The spring could be very small. You know, a 20 hertz sound wave, I think, would be pretty large. So this structure would be you know, a lot smaller than that 20 hertz wavelength. Would that then give you a 20 hertz you know, wavelength capture area? And how would you be able to tell the difference between one that did have that capture area and one that did not? I guess you'd compare it to the piezoelectric speaker without the spring attached. I don't know if that's a valid test. Anyway, that's my thought of how you build a small 20 hertz speaker, AC2IS.
As I see it, you definitely get a size multiplication when you use resonance. But now you've got a very small bandwidth. You've got a finite rise time and fall time. You have other characteristics. You're not going to get an instantaneous response out of that acting as a microphone when a 20 hertz signal is applied to it. Because of its resonance, it's going to take some number of cycles to build up the resonance of that spring moving the way you described. And is that piece of metal on the end of the spring going to be moving enough air compared to a full-size 20 hertz loudspeaker? I've got a little bit of a problem with that one, so I'm not sure on this one. I've got to go away. Bye-bye, Bill. Over to you, Roy, KGRIW.
Okay, thanks again, Dick. I appreciate entertaining this interesting question. Anyone with any other comments or questions? I was going to do a puzzler, but I think I got something like 12 minutes, so I thought I would do a couple interesting articles that hopefully we can discuss. So I'll let it drop for a second if anyone has any comments to make before I begin.
Well, you could take up more time. I'm not going to be able to utilize a whole hour. Back to you, WS20.
Hey, thanks, Paul. Well, I'll start with the articles, and we'll see how it goes, because I have a lot of articles, and I don't think I'll go through too many. You know, I don't want to take up too much of Paul's time. The first article that I like to talk about, if you recall, last week I was doing a story about television display technologies. I was talking about organic light-emitting diodes, emissive display technology, and the so-called QLED transmissive display technology. And at that time, if you recall, Dick brought up a very intriguing way that nature has provided coloration to some species of animals. Instead of synthesizing a dye or a pigment to reflect the color back, they have designed bioengineered nanostructures to produce interface patterns that cancel out some colors and reinforce others. It's for this reason that things like my Morphos butterfly, whose image is on my link page, roy.ac2gs.com, by the way, appears to be a vivid blue. It actually is a consequence of the interference of the light that gets reflected off of its nanostructure surface. Internally, it has no dyes or pigments in it at all, which got me to think about another display technology that presently does not really lend itself to television, but that you might see on other devices, and that is e-ink, sometimes called e-paper, seen in all those Kindle readers that Amazon is selling. This display technology is neither emissive nor transmissive. Like my Morphos butterfly, it uses reflective technology. You see, each pixel of the e-ink display is actually a transparent sphere, the diameter of a fine hair, with very small charged particles immersed in a clear fluid. The black particles are designed to be negatively charged, while the white particles are designed to be positively charged. There's a two-dimensional array of these capsules arranged with an addressable array of transparent conductors sandwiched right above and right below the layer of the capsules. By adjusting the charge potential of the opposing layers of transparent conductors, the top of the sphere can attract either the negatively charged white particles or the positively charged black particles to produce the reflective display. Now, modern displays can offer 16 levels of gray, and they continue to work on developing a cost-effective color display technology. E-ink has the benefit of wide viewing angle and low power requirement. The screen remains the same even after your power is removed. In addition, some people find the reflective display much more paper-like and find it easier to read using it. The big limitation with e-ink has to do with the incredibly slow refresh rate.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout, cancel.
Okay, I thought I was going to get away with it. Anyway, so the limitations is that the e-ink has a very low, slow refresh rate, making it great for stable images but useless for anything that needs rapid, repeated image refreshes. So let me drop for any questions or comments. This is AC2GS.
GX.
Yes, Rich.
So I would think that you could erase a page of e-ink by running a statically charged balloon over it.
It's an interesting question. I guess theoretically, if the electrostatic charge was high enough, you could do that.
Interesting idea. Interesting applications.
Joyous comment.
Yes, Bill.
Interestingly, there is e-ink and e-paper, and they are different technologies. One being, I think, zero power consuming, and the other just being very low power consuming when there's not a screen update going on. If you're talking at the moment, I get them confused. But I believe you're talking about the zero power consumption technology. And there is actually a three-color version of that has to do with different use of different charged particle sizes. Typical is white, black, and red. So they, I guess they have a way of generating a matrix charge behind the display as well as in front of the display. Then when they want to, I guess when they put the charge behind it, I think everything goes white. And then when they put the charge in front, it attracts charged particles towards the front that are black. And then to get the third color, if they leave in that you know, matrix, if they leave a charge on the front of the display for an extended period of time, the smaller particles then come further to the front, displacing large particles, and smaller particles would, say, be the red third color. Take longer to get your red. How that works, ACGIS.
Oh, that's very good, Bill. There are many iterations of E-ink technology. I think there are five generations, and there are subgroups that kind of launch out to the side. I don't know if e-paper has an inherent defined term. They tend to kind of be messy about using them almost synonymously, although there's some slight variation. And they have tried numerous types of methods to develop a color e-ink. They have tried, the simplest approach was simply to use absorptive filters and have a pixel for red, green, and blue, and just use the standard white-black paradigm of the earliest version of e-ink. Then they've tried a bicolor that wasn't white and black, and mixing them around. They've tried tricolor. They've tried pixel triplets of bicolor. They're trying all kinds of fun things. I don't think they have industrially. I think they've produced them for expensive pieces of equipment, but in the consumer region, I don't think you can find any color e-ink technology. It's fascinating. I have a Kindle. I'm a little disappointed. I think the form factor is a little too small for me personally. I prefer a somewhat bigger screen, but they seem to have standardized to those tiny little screens. And, but it's interesting technology.
D2IS comment.
Yes, Bill.
I don't know where he got it, but a friend of mine got a three-color e-ink or e-paper, whatever it is, display. It's about the size, display size of, I guess, an iPad mini. He, for whatever reason, he's using it for a calendar application, sort of a self-updating calendar.
That's interesting. I've heard that they've used them in an industrial designs. Maybe either that was an industrial sample, or he has, you know, some company had extras that they were selling at a cut rate or something. That would be interesting to take a look at. I mean, all this is very fascinating, and especially one of the things I tend to, well, there's two big things I like about it. It's very energy efficient, having to recharge my iPads incessantly. And I do, on a theoretical basis, like the reflective method that it displays images. You know, looking at computer screens is fine, but having those lights kind of glow at you all day long can burn out your retinas a bit. Any other questions or comments on this subject, or I'll move over to the next one. Well, Wuhan coronavirus got its permanent destination, and it's clear that it did not come from a guy at marketing. They want to call it COVID, that's COVID, COVID-19, and it stands for Corona virus disease 2019. The first COVID-19 related death outside of Asia, by the way, was recently reported in France. Now, up until recently, both South America and Africa were free of any COVID-19 infection reports, but now apparently a case has been found in Egypt, so Africa isn't getting away free from this, unfortunately. Even those construction workers that we talked about that built a new hospital in 10 days to house the Wuhan growing number of COVID-19 cases weren't safe. At least two of those workers have recently been reported to have been infected with the virus. So at present, if you're keeping count, there have been 71,280 reported cases of COVID-19 infection with 1,773 reported deaths due to this virus. Now, if you remember SARS, supposedly, SARS only killed 800 people when it ran in 2002-2003. And as always, keep in mind that these numbers are likely to be underreported because China tends to do that. In fact, on February 11th, they changed the protocol of reporting the numbers of new cases, and there was this sharp rise that they said wasn't because the virus was getting away from everyone, but simply because their reporting was more accurate. So go figure. Anyway, let me drop for any questions or comments. This is AC2GS. Okay, very well. On with the next. Medical quacks are trying to sell the very bad idea of swallowing silver to ward off the virus, something that's more likely to turn you into a real-life smurf than cure anything. This past Wednesday, Right-Wing Watch, a arm of the progressive advocacy group People for the American Way, highlighted one such quack on their Twitter account. They shared a clip from conservative televangelist Jim Baker's self-named online show. The clip is taken from the February 12th episode, billed as A Close-Up at What's Not Being Said About Coronavirus, Part 1. In the clip, Baker holds up a bottle labeled Silver Solution and asks guest Cheryl Selman whether it's true that it would be effective against, quote, this influenza, end quote, inaccurately referring to the new coronavirus. Selman, who calls herself a naturopath, first briefly notes that the product hasn't been tested on this strain of coronavirus before assuring the audience that it truly can kill off the virus within 12 hours. She then adds that silver will take the immune system and make it vibrant. Silver does have some ability to kill microorganisms like viruses, particularly when it's deployed through tiny nanoparticles in a medical setting. But the so-called alternative medicine world has turned it into a panacea capable of curing practically anything. In that context, it's often sold in a liquid form as colloidal silver. Although it can be taken by mouth by the spoonful, it's also put into lozenges and topical gels, all products that Jim Baker's show advertises during its broadcast as part of a cold and flu special sale. Let me drop for a sec. Earlier this month, the Silver Health Institute, run by someone named Gordon Peterson, recommended via a very badly written press release that silver be used to kill the coronavirus. Peterson himself, who claims to have won a bronze medal at the 2003 Utah Winter Games, although the Winter Games in Utah were actually held in 2002, so he seems to have been a year late, argued that since silver will destroy all forms of viruses, it will help protect people from the coronavirus. Now, there's absolutely no evidence that taking colloidal silver will keep you safe from the new coronavirus, nor boost your immune system. Chronic dosages of silver, on the other hand, can and will build up in your body and cause your skin to turn this interesting permanently grayish-blue. It's a condition called argyra. So, if you are interested in permanently looking like a smurf, colloidal silver might be for you. Otherwise, I would stick with washing your hands and staying away from sick people coughing and sneezing in the surrounding area. Let me drop for any questions or comments. This is AC2GS. Okay, on with the next. I thought after Lou NY2H's unfortunate problems with his Baofeng speaker, it might be interesting to go over the different sound levels of events here on Mother Earth. Ahead of the 2011 NBA playoff, Dallas Maverick owner Mark Cuban had the team's home stadium outfitted with a revamped acoustic system. microphones in the backboard transmitted speaker squeaks and players' voices through 60 gargantuan speakers, which also amplified and circulated sound from the crowd. Fans couldn't get enough of the din. As time expired, Dallas emerged victorious after a seemingly impossible comeback. The audience roared at 115 decibels, exactly the threshold of human pain. Down in Central and South America, the lesser bulldog bat produces an ear-shattering cry that would be downright painful to us if we could only hear it. Their 137-decibel calls are, thankfully, ultrasonic, meaning that their pitch is above the limits of our perception, so our feeble human ears fail to take notice. High-frequency sound doesn't travel exceptionally far, causing the need for an extreme shriek to extend their hunting range. The bat's super-powered volume helps them echolocate to zero in on a small, swift insect meal. Howler monkeys really earn their name. The extra-large hyoid bones in their vocal tract house massive air sacs that amplify their bombastic voice to superlative heights. They are often regarded as the loudest of any land animal at 140 decibels. When groups of them start, well, howling, the ruckus is audible for 3 miles away. Primatologists theorize that the monkeys do this as a way to tell any potential intruder that their territory is very much occupied, or possibly as a way to guard their mates. According to the Center for Disease and Control and Prevention, any noise louder than 120 decibels can immediately damage your tiny little ear cells that help turn vibrations into what our brains perceive as sound. Most guns, like pistols and rifles, clock in at least 140 decibels when fired, and you can get as high as 190 decibels. Neglecting proper protection often results in permanent high-pitched hearing loss, particularly the loss of hearing S's, sibilances, TH's, and V sounds. And tinnitus, or ringing in the ear. Most don't realize there's a problem until it's too late. Let me drop for a sec. Developed for the Apollo program, NASA's Saturn V rocket is a decorated record holder. It's the tallest, most powerful spacecraft to successfully fly. The behemoth has launched 13 times, propelling 260,145 pounds of payload into orbit on each go. A portion of the rocket, called the S1C stage, generates around 7.5 million pounds of thrust to do that. All that power translates into quite a bit of noise, which NASA dampens by dousing the launch area in curtains of water to absorb the pressure waves, but it still has measured as high as 204 decibels. Type Chelyabinsk meteor into YouTube, and you can experience this explosion for yourself. A handful of Russian dashboard cameras caught it on tape. A force equal to 500 kilotons of TNT shattered glass and tossed debris throughout the city, injuring more than 1,000 people. Big booms typically emit a lot of far-reaching ruckus called infrasound, which is too low frequency for human ears to pick up. Chelyabinsk was no exception, with deep tones hitting sensors 9,000 miles away in Antarctica. 90 decibels was measured 435 miles away, and the calculated noise level only 3 miles away was calculated to be around 180 decibels. On June morning in 1908, a shockwave knocked a Siberian man off of his seat on the front porch. The Tunguska meteorite was to blame. It had burst in midair 40 miles away with a blast equivalent of 650 Hiroshima bombs. Eyewitnesses said that the shattering space rock rang like artillery shells from the distance and was as bright as the sun. There's no evidence of any fatalities, but the meteorite flattened at least 600 square miles of forest, leaving 80 million felled trees to rest in a radial pattern. Its calculated noise level 3 miles away was about 197 decibels. Let me drop for a sec. When Krakatoa erupted in 1893, it obliterated more than half of the island's landmass, created 100-foot-tall tsunamis, and deafened anyone. It didn't kill for miles around. The death toll was over 36,000. Zanzibar beachgoers discovered washed-up human skeletons melted into slabs of pumice as long as 9 months afterwards, even thousands of miles away in New